Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Good evening, everyone. Tonight, Vanessa will be our speaker, and the talk is titled Entering the Coffin. Welcome, Vanessa.
Thank you, Bonnie. And good evening, everybody. Nice to see everybody. Can you hear me okay? Hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. So some of you might know one of the things that I spend my time doing is putting together and editing this website called The Dewdrop that contains things that are good for reading, according to me. And I did something quite recently that I'd never done before, was I self-published. I published a story that I'd written myself. And it was pretty scary to put it up on my own platform. But it was a fun story. It was about my daughter and her best friend, and about the relationship that they have, which is really beautiful. And they've known each other since they were 18 months old, and they have this very natural draw towards each other that has endured a whole 3.5 years, which is a hell of a long time when you're their age. So it's a very heartwarming story. And after I published it a few days later, I got a message from my mom. And my mom sometimes gives me feedback about the things that I do. But she sent me a message saying, Vanessa, that was a lovely story. And what a relief to finally read something nice from you and just not all that stuff you're always posting about death. and she's got a point. Like I do post a lot of things about death because I think about death a lot. I don't know if I think about death more than most people do, but it's something that I try and keep in sight as much as possible, because I'm interested in the perspective that brings to my life. So what I want to share with you tonight, quite personally, some of the darker repercussions of this relationship that I have, you know, the shadow side, because I'm confident that I think a lot of these shadows that come up, they're the reason that I'm sitting here this evening with you. And I think they're important. And why not talk about death a few days before Halloween, and a few days before a general election next week, something to just cheer us up a bit and take our mind off the politics. So there's a poem that I found recently by a poet called Ross Gay. And the poem's called Thank You. So I'm gonna read it out. If you find yourself half naked and barefoot in the frosty grass, hearing again the earth's great sonorous moan that says you are the heir of the now and gone, that says all you love will turn to dust and will meet you there, do not raise your fist. Do not raise your small voice against it. And do not take cover. Instead, curl your toes into the grass. Watch the cloud ascending from your lips. Walk through the garden's dormant splendor. Say only, thank you. Thank you. So I'll leave that to hang in the air. I'll come back to that in a little while. So I've been able to watch my daughter since she was born. And I think one of the things that's amazed me the most is the state when she was born, that this relationship that she had with the world, that this understanding of a newborn baby that was this kind of completely holistic experience. And I've read that newborn babies in the first few weeks of life don't even really perceive a difference or a separation between themselves and their mothers or even the rest of the world. A very fluid state of experience. And I'd had this, but I never really understood it until I had a child, until I became a mother. And I had the opportunity to be up close to a human who was developing from scratch. And what I saw was how gradually things started to delineate, to take shape in her world. So experiences started to separate one from the other and become distinct, as did people. And I was really bowled over by the trust that she had in me and in the world, this kind of sense of boundlessness. She lived in this sort of continuous, endless presence that, you know, we all strive for now without question. And you could call it sort of a trust, like a trust in being held. And then she started to grow and she got curious and started asking questions. And in trying to give answers to help her, I saw how I myself was beginning to curtail that sense of infinity that she had. I watched as the concept of like life stages took root in her mind, and the idea of adulthood as a far off prospect, and then also, of course, death. And for her, for this person who was steeped in this radical sort of daily change, you know, in the same way that a fish is steeped in water, that there was this kind of jolt, this rupture, you know, as these things kind of began to form for her. And I thought, that doesn't feel right. You know, to be told some of these things kind of goes against a child's instinct that her being is infinite. Because to be finite means to have edges and borders, and it implies a beginning and an ending. And I think to a young child, this is very counterintuitive. So then I perceived this shift, that this sort of inner sense of boundlessness or eternity that you might carry as a new human being, when it's denied, I think that it's externalized. So I think that suddenly you shrink, the person shrinks and goes from being vast to very, very tiny, and from being integrated to separated. And now the infinity is outside of you. It's in space and time. And it's no longer the ripe joy of all-pervading consciousness. It's a kind of a hollow, dark emptiness that goes on and on and on and on. And you, this tiny little person, are alone and you're floating within that. And you're brought in against your will, and you're going to be kicked out against your will as well one day. So this kind of image used to overwhelm me and fill me with panic. And I would get lost in this darkness, and I would hyperventilate and sweat and shake, and I would sit up and look around and try to latch onto something physical, something tangible that reassured me that the world was still there, you know, that substance was still there, and bring me back to a familiar place. And I think it's a common image. I think it's a common fear, a common nightmare, you know. But I think when you're under its spell, it's easy to think you're the only person in the world that this is happening to. So one night when I was about 15 years old, when I was a teenager, I had a panic attack that was so bad that my mum, who couldn't bring me out of it at all. She called a friend to come over. This friend of hers was a nurse, and she was also a very devout Christian. And she was a wonderful, wonderful, calming presence. And I remember her telling me that what I was going through was normal, and that I needed to trust in the fact that as I grew older, I would find answers to my questions, whether it was through religion or some other avenue. The first thing that strikes me about that poem, that Roscoe poem, thank you, is that the person in the poem, or and vulnerable. He says that this person is half naked and they're cold, they're in the freezing grass and their voice is small. And that's how it feels to be afraid. And the poem says, well, when you find yourself there, what do you do? When you're told that everything you love will turn to dust, what can you do? And the first thing that he suggests are the do nots. Do not raise your fist. Do not raise your small voice against it. Do not take cover. And I never thought that taking cover was something to do. I thought of taking cover as sort of taking blind refuge in some ways. And as I went into early adulthood, I made a very definite and lucid decision for myself to leave behind any idea of a religious faith or some kind of philosophical religious framework that would hold me up. I was determined to experience the world on my own terms and make up my own mind, no matter how frightening that prospect would be. And what followed then in the following years was on an existential level, a very, very difficult period. It was a kind of home leaving that coincided with my actual home leaving. And it left me completely without a sort of a moral compass or any kind of relative value system with which to orient myself. I was adrift and ill at ease, which is a very British way of saying I was horribly depressed and in a crisis. And the thought of my own mortality was heavy enough, but what more outweighed that was observing the way in which the world continued in the light of this fact, you know, in the light of this sort of what seemed to me the truth of our condition. I didn't feel that it was reflected in the way that society was structured or in the way that anybody lived their lives. I just felt that everything was a distraction from, you know, sort of from facing up to this very fundamental truth. And I felt it for a long time. It was in my bones, like it really possessed me. I couldn't really think about anything else, or I couldn't really frame the world in any other way for a long time. And it was overwhelming. It felt a little bit like madness sometimes. It was hard to do sort of normal everyday things because every person I spoke to, every movie I watched, every street I walked down, like it just lit up this predicament for me. I couldn't get away from it. And then around this time, I discovered meditation, but that's not the happy ending at all. Discovering meditation for me at that moment, when these things were so alive for me, actually caused more of a problem. Because what I did was I signed myself up for, I didn't start or go to like a beginner's class or you know, start gently. I signed myself up for a full 10-day silent Vipassana retreat in India. Bam. And it was, you know, it was just really strong. It was like, you know, taking a very strong shot of something before I was really prepared for it. I thought I was going in to experience something relaxing that would calm me. But I think given the state of mind that I went in, it was very, very different from that. 10 days with absolutely no distractions, with no reading, no writing, no talking to anybody, not even making eye contact with anybody, and sitting for, gosh, 14 hours a day, I think it was, like a lot of time, sometimes in these very small like meditation cells, which sort of, I'm claustrophobic anyway, sort of claustrophobic, piled upon like panic and existential crisis and fear of annihilation, just everything came up, of course it did, you know, everything just came up all at once, and I was not equipped in that moment to handle it. It was a very scary experience. About a year and a half later, I started sitting with a Zen group, and this was back in England. And when I did, it was a very different kind of experience. And I realized I'd found a practice that would pull me through, that was my raft. One of the things I started to realize then was that you can't think your way out of everything or anything, really, but definitely not everything. That my life, like the whole thing, was a practice of mind and body together. So both of them flawed, sometimes beautiful, sometimes wretched, undeniably transient. But in sitting, I began to experience an ease, an easing. And there were no answers and there were no great moments of illumination, but instead there was a falling away. And this falling away was not something that I'd previously considered, that questions and concerns, instead of being resolved, might just drop. It was a whole other way of being, or of seeing the world, of framing the world. And I began to learn that the Buddha, when the Buddha talked about life and death, he talked about this. He talked about resetting the parameters of the way we think about existence and non-existence. So the Buddha said, if you're asking about death as something that's opposed to life, then you're asking a futile question, because what you're asking really needs to be reframed. And this is just a little quote I found from the Samyukta Agama Sutta, which is the discourse on the middle way. When a person who has correct insight observes the coming to be of the world, the idea of non-being does not arise in her. And when she observes the fading away of the world, the idea of being does not arise in her mind. Viewing the world as being is an extreme. Viewing it as non-being is another extreme. Dwelling in the middle way is what he's talking about. So in this Buddhist view, life and death are not events that can be delineated or called events in that same sense. And so reflecting on that, of actual experience I've had of, you know, the coming and going of life, I think I'm really fortunate to be a woman, to have been able to, you know, create life or to have life grow in my body. And I also, some years ago before my daughter was born, I had the very profound experience of nursing my grandmother for many months at home while she succumbed to lung cancer. And in both cases, I was very intimate with this manifestation of life and death, of this kind of process of becoming, as I saw it, of kind of arising and falling. And I realized that, of course, you don't just experience them as events in themselves. There's this sort of imperceptible, like fade in and fade out. And there are markers along the way. You know, obviously in my daughter's case, there's a pregnancy test, and there's a scan, and there's vomiting, and then there's the birth. In my grandmother's case, there was a diagnosis, and there was a progression of physical sort of degradation, of getting worse and worse physically. There was a moment when her heart stopped and she didn't breathe anymore, which is called the moment of death. But when I was that intimate with her at the time, I think what I was able to understand was the fact that her dying was a very long death, included everybody around her. And it was impossible to pinpoint a beginning or an end. You know, it was, 16 years ago now. And to me, that process is still going on. You know, it's not finished. She's still alive. And there's still that process of dying that's happening for me. And then the same, you know, the other way for life on the ascent. I remember so clearly, like, the moment when I first realized that, like, Cora, my daughter, existed. I was on a sesshin in Liverpool, and I was sharing a room with three other girls, and we were all there in our bunk beds, and I think we were just resting between meditations. And then somebody jumped up and said, "Oh, I'm going to go to the shop. Does anybody want anything?" And the girl next to me on the bunk across the room, she just called out, "Beef jerky." and I was lying there and I was like, "Beef jerky, yes." And I didn't realize, I'd just been having this craving, you know. I was like, "Beef jerky." It just needed somebody to say it. And I was like, I'm going to see that beef jerky. And it was very, very strange, because it's just not something I would ordinarily eat. And that was it. You know, it was just this kind of first, like, bizarre feeling in my body. I didn't know that I was pregnant. You know, I didn't know that my daughter was there already. But there was a change, you know, there was a shift. And that was just one little sign of life that for me is, it's indistinguishable from the moment that she was born, that I met her, because I knew her, you know, from beef jerky. So entering your coffin, that image or that phrase comes from a quote by Kodo Suwaki, when he says, he would like to say, sitting zazen is like entering your coffin. And then he followed that up by saying that, you know, one of the ways in which it's like entering your coffin is that you do it whether you like it or not. Yeah, that's one aspect. So not giving yourself the choice. And then he goes on to say, sit thinking that you have died. So understand your own extinction as part of your being, as being indistinguishable from your being in this very moment. The definition of your being involves and implies its extinction. It's impermanent. It's temporary by nature, and it's always subject to change. So you're as good as dead. It's just a matter of time. And then also within that, there's a sense of urgency, right? So you sit in a way as if every moment was your last. And I think it was Kodo Suwaki, or possibly Taizen Deshimaru, who was his student, who said, you know, you need to practice like there's a fire burning on your head, you know, and you let that knowledge of that fear of your mortality and your impermanence, that can be the fuel that drives your rockets in this moment. Like if you go to Tassajara or any of the other, when you go and see a Han, you know, the wood that struck before zazen, the wood that struck to call us into zazen. And there's often something, there's a verse that's written on it. And the verse is usually a version of this poem, which says, "Life and death are of grave importance, impermanent and swift. Wake up, all of you, do not waste your life." That's the call to the Zendo, That's the call to Zazen. Sitting Zazen is like entering your coffin, in that Zazen is also often compared to a mirror. So it's a motion of turning inwards, and it's a cultivation of presence. It's a way of being able to sit with yourself and anything that comes up within yourself. So the ease inherent in Zazen is the falling away of boundaries. So we say we drop the dualistic mind and we cease to differentiate. So the borders and the definitions drop away. Like sometimes when I'm sitting, there's a complete absence of fear. And I'm curious and I go to look for it and it's gone. And it's really gone. I can't find it. It's a strong practice. I think Kodo Suwaki is saying, you sit as though you're preparing to die, because you realize in that moment that you can't hold on to anything. Because your nature, your pure human conscious nature is reflective. It's not something that can accumulate anything. It's reflective. So Zazen is entering your coffin, but I also feel it as re-entering my crib. Because in that poem, in Ross Gay's poem, when he says, don't fight back, don't raise your voice, don't take cover, what he then says in the positive, he says, instead, curl your toes, curl them into the grass, watch the cloud ascend from your lips, walk through the garden's dormant splendor. And these are peaceful actions. They're simple actions. It's rooting yourself into the earth, watching and walking, passing through. So then in the Shobogenzo, there's a chapter called Shoji. And Shoji translates both as life and death, and then also in the kind of doing, in the verb living and dying. It can be said to be both. And in it, Dogen writes, seeking Buddha outside of living and dying is like facing south, hoping to see the North Star. Seeking Buddha outside of living and dying is like facing south, hoping to see the North Star. When there is nothing we cling to and nothing we hate, then we enter the heart of Buddha. Our practice is growth through diminishment. So going back to my website, there's a post that I put up in December of last year that went sort of weirdly viral, relatively viral to the amount of traffic I normally get, in like March or April. And it still continues to be the most read page of the whole site by far. And it's really curious to me why that is, because I think there's a lot of good stuff up there. But, you know, why this particular conversation? But I love it. What it is, it's a transcript of a conversation that was a podcast that I heard by a very popular podcaster who you may or may not have heard of, called Duncan Trussell. And it was a conversation with his mum, a lady called Deneen Fendig. It was taped back in 2013 when Deneen was receiving palliative care for cancer. She was in the process of active dying and had only days left to live. The conversation is really, really amazing, and I recommend that you listen to it. The one part of it that I honed on was this section when her son asks Deneen how she's feeling and what's going on for her in this state, within this state of active dying. And she's a tremendously articulate and self-aware woman. And she replies that, you know, among other things, she had this feeling of being held. And when Duncan asks her to elaborate on that, she answered the following. And I'm going to read out what she said. When I go deeper than the mental, direct knowing, and I can directly know holding without having to have a picture of somebody holding me. I think that that would distract me from the experience of holding, which is an ultimately marvelous experience of being held. And being held is inseparable from holding. So there's a reciprocity of being held and holding. It's different from I'm a little girl, I'm being held by my mama. It's not that. But there is a sense that we are all held and we don't realize it. Why don't we realize it? Because we've done so much with our mental conceptualization that we miss what's right under our noses. We can directly know through dropping into what our current experience is right now. And if you and everybody who listens to this can do that, what you will find is holding. You don't have to be dying to find that. It's a given. So what I take from that beautiful description of holding, is something similar to the wide openness and the trust, that boundlessness that my daughter had in her first years and continues to have in many, many ways, although she's already 5 years old. I think that very young children feel held in this way as well. So it's a beautiful symmetry. End of life, beginning of life. And, you know, my daughter's been very interested in questions of life and death since she was like 3 years old. And she's aware of these matters, and I know she thinks about them very deeply. And when those questions first started to come, it kind of, you know, it shook me, like, already, whoa. She was afraid, you know, there were moments where she was fearful. And what I wanted to do as her mother was just pull that fear out of her. But I realized, or when you realize, when I realized I can't do that, that's a big moment in parenting. I'm glad that my mom did what she did for me that night when she called her friend in to talk to me. That conversation has had a lasting impact in my life. But I've thought often that should I be in her position, I'd want to be able to step up to the plate for my daughter and myself. And I would somehow see doing that as the fruit of my practice. So I can't take away her fear, but what I tell her is this. I tell her that you hold that feeling, because when you question, when that question comes up and that fear arises, you stay right there and you look it in the eye, because it's the question that will drive you forward. Never lose sight of it and never neglect it because you think you've resolved it. And be grateful. I'm going to read it one more time. Thank You by Ross Gay. If you find yourself half naked and barefoot in the frosty grass, hearing again the earth's great sonorous moan that says you are the heir of the now and gone, that says all you love will turn to dust and will meet you there. Do not raise your fist. Do not raise your small voice against it. And do not take cover. Instead, curl your toes into the grass. Watch the cloud ascending from your lips. Walk through the garden's dormant splendor. Say only, thank you, thank you. Now I'd like to hear from you. If you have any, what comes up for you when you hear all of that, or any questions, or.
Hi, Vanessa.
Okay. Hi.
I have a question for
Uma.
I just want to ask you something. You know, you were talking about death, and I was thinking about Halloween too.
Yeah.
Halloween is there to scare the heebie-jeebies out of us. You know, it's like all the stuff that we have, all the cobwebs that we have, all the places that scare us, you know, things, monsters come out and people are there to scare us. And I was thinking about this, and I was thinking, this is really interesting that, you know, our practices like Halloween, you go and sit there and, you know, you're dealing with all your monsters and they show up and they scare the heebie-jeebies out of you. And it's a really interesting place to be. But the other thing that came out of it for me was that after sitting, you know, there's a sense of calmness that comes out and the sense of joy that comes out. And what happens is that there's a sense of joy that says that, yes, I am going to die, I know. But why not live life with this sense of happiness? The sense that, you know, everything, I'm happy and I'm thankful for what I have. You know, the breath that I have, the strength that I have in my body, whatever it is, the people that I'm surrounded by, the love that I've gotten, everything that has come into my life and made my life possible. For me, there's this sense of gratitude that comes up, and I just find it to be amazing. It just gives me more strength and more vitality to think about that constantly. You know, it's just like it's the other day I was standing outside talking to my neighbor, and the bird, one of the finches came by and sat on the gutter of his house and looked at me and tweeted at me. I'm like, what's going on here? And he was saying to me that the water's dirty, go change it. You know, so I had to go and change the water. But it's just like, but it was just joyful for me to do that little, small little thing, you know. And that's what I find happiness now. It's just like there's a sense of joy. There's a sense of happiness that comes out of sitting and knowing that you're going to die, knowing that you're going to have to go and sit with your demons. But having this sense of fantastic joy and awe of nature. And, you know, it's just, I've started to feel that, and it's taken a long time, but I just have started to feel, yes, death is there and it's always there, but why not live in joy, live with happiness, live with this calmness and this confidence that this, our practice is there and this is what we trust. I just wanted to share that with you. Thank you for your talk tonight.
Thank Wonderful. You.
Dave.
Well, I guess just following on those last lines of the poem, Vanessa, I just want to say thank you, thank you, thank you. I think it's wonderful the way you're able to talk about something as big as the great matter of birth and death and yet tie it to shared intimacy with your own experiences and relate that to us. So thank you for that. What you said about Cora and watching her as she's grown from a baby reminds me of one of my favorite lines of poetry. and I'm sure you're probably familiar with it too. It's Wordsworth's Intimations of Immortality, where he says, in part, "Heaven lies about us in our infancy. Shades of the prison house begin to close upon the growing boy. But he beholds the light, and whence it flows, he sees it in his joy." There's a funny story that I love, even though I'm probably thinking that it's one of those things that should be true, it probably isn't, about a mother overhearing her young son going over to the crib of his younger brother and saying, "Remind me where we come from. I'm beginning to forget." I was also struck by your remark about the crib and the coffin. I mean, in a way, they really are sort of similar, but going in opposite directions. You know, the crib sort of carries us back to before our birth, and the coffin carries us forward after our death. And I've always sort of wondered, I wonder if you have any insights into this. We seem to be wired up to fear non-existence after death, but we seem to be completely free of fear about non-existence before our birth. And yet it's the same. Why do they feel so different?
I think we are heavily invested in the directionality of time. It's very convincing, and it's where we live. There's just one direction as far as we can see, and we have a tendency to think that what's past is past, and it's what's coming that we should worry about. But it makes no sense when you think about it that way. Surely eternity is on all sides.
Perhaps this relates also to what Suzuki Roshi said: every moment contains its own past and future.
Vanessa, I have a question.
Hey, Nick.
Hi, thank you for your talk. I especially appreciated hearing the teachings on our Zazen practice in relation to death by Sawaki Roshi and Deshimaru Roshi. And I'm curious if you wouldn't mind sharing a few more words on how particularly our Shikantaza practice relates to death. Because when you shared those quotes by them, I was remembering how our Dharma cousins in the Tibetan Buddhist schools, they have probably one of the most sophisticated meditation practices that is specifically targeted towards training them for the moment of death. And the Tibetans even produced the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which is all about, you know, preparing for what will be the state of your mind when you enter the bardo. And I'm just curious, what is our school's practice for that? How does Shikantaza prepare us for the moment of our death?
I'm not so familiar, you know, with that. I've only read a little bit about the Tibetan methods that you're talking about, so I can't speak to them so much, but as far as I know, we don't have such an equivalent directly, you know, in Zen that is so focused, so intensely focused on this sort of moment of dying. And maybe somebody can correct me, or somebody can let me know if we do have something like that. But I started sitting in the Deshimaru lineage, and so I got kind of big doses of that, like when I first started sitting, of hearing that and sitting with that, you know, the a lot of emphasis on urgency. I think it kind of relates back a little bit to what I was just talking about, what Dave was just talking about, you know, this understanding that it's not about what's in the past and what's in the future. That all of it is right here. Like the truth of all of that, the fact of all of that is the essence of what's happening right now. And it's understanding that. I had this experience once that with another relative who was very old, and I'd grown up with her, and she was sort of a great grandmother figure to me. So that by the time in my 20s, she was already in her 90s, and she was becoming very frail. And I'd always known her to be this very sort of strong woman. And I was to go and visit her in her apartment where she was living, and she had a nurse living with her. And it was, you know, sort of very close to the end of her life. And I was very young, and I hadn't really sort of been around anybody who was that sick or frail before. And I was nervous before going in, you know. I really felt like that this would, you know, enhance all of this, you know, other stuff that I was going through, and I didn't know how to deal with it. And then I just had this incredible experience when I walked into the apartment and I saw her there, and she was very frail, you know, and she looked very vulnerable and very old. She didn't look like the lady that I remembered. And yet when I saw her, something came down for me where I had this experience that I was there with myself, that I was there with her, but there was nothing between us. There was no difference between us at all. So she was there and she was older and she was dying. But I had no advantage over her. Because I wasn't. I had no advantage over her for that reason. My youth, my point in time, my temporality conferred no advantage on me. Because in essence, we were in the same boat. And it just completely blasted any sense of like pity I might have had walking into that room, you know. And it just sort of brought us into this kind of unity of like, okay. You know, this is happening now. It's a facing up to that. You know, it's just being able to have that in the room with you, and that's how I take the sitting, and you know, sitting zazen is like entering into your coffin. It's just being able to sit in that tiny, very uncomfortable space, just breath by breath. Thank you, Nick.
Thank you, Vanessa. And congratulations for getting through a 10-day Vipassana retreat as your very first retreat.
I very nearly ran away, but I made it.
Well, when I was younger, I felt that if people really believed what they said, then the world would be very different, you know? And I wonder if that, it sounds like you had that similar perspective, and I wonder how that has changed for you as you've aged and as you've become a parent. That also is a tiring way to live, at least from my own experience. So how do you see that changing as we age?
What do you mean when you said what was the tiring experience for you?
Really just, you know, being at odds with what I perceive to be the collective beliefs of people and the how I perceive people's actions to be, and the disparity between the two, like, you know, and it's you know, and again, in the early existentialist writings, it has a lot to do with faith and belief, but in more modern writings, it has more to do with virtue and or hypocrisy, and you know, just railing against the world. You know, you could read any Dylan Thomas poem, you're like, you know, it's tiring. I wish the world were the way it should be, but it's not. And I found that when, you know, I became a dad, that I had to really like look at that, because it wasn't just for me, and I needed to have a healthy way to not only think about the world, but to live in it and to allow for other people to live in it in a healthy way. So, yeah, I mean, you are very present and available for your daughter. And I just wondering about how you see that shift, you know, particularly in light of how you had a lot of meditation and Zen, you know, time with Zen prior to being a parent, and then now to be a parent relatively later in life, and having the ability to see this little person grow up.
I really relate to your point about, you know, applying practice to parenthood, I guess, you know, mm-hmm. I guess I referred to it as the fruit of practice, you know, earlier, but how the fruit of the practice is so just obviously in so many parts of your life, but I don't know, for me, especially in parenthood, which has been one of the most challenging periods. I find myself with Cora often apologizing for the world when I'm explaining certain things to her. You know, I find that my tone is kind of apologetic, like, really sorry about global warming, but like, these are the myriad ways in which we have screwed up, and this is the world you're going to inherit. I kind of come up against that for myself, you know? I'm like, I don't need to apologize, you know? I think what's more helpful is to just be able to introduce her and give her the help her develop the skills that, you know, she'll need to deal. Mm-hmm.
So you move like, instead of just like vacillating between idealism and realism, you're like, here's the practical stuff. Because you've got to live in the world just like I have, right?
Your toolkit.
Yeah.
Your mother's toolkit. Take it.
I can totally relate.
Yeah. But also, I mean, I think that, you know, again, you mentioned sort of, going back to that person who, incomprehension, it's funny to look back on now. It's strange for me to look back on that period, because I don't worry nearly so much about the things that you mentioned, like hypocrisy or values, or it just doesn't rub me in the same way. You know, it's like the poem at the end, or what Umar was talking about, you know, just walking in the garden now, like, that's it. Teresa.
Hi, Vanessa. Thank you for your talk. I enjoyed it a lot. I have a question for you about, you know, you talk about being with your grandmother when he was very sick. And my question is, you talk about death, but about your relationship with people you love and who are not longer here. You know, how Thich Nhat Hanh says that if you pay attention, you will be able to see somebody you loved in a flower or a cloud. But, you know, for me, for some people who passed away and whom I really love, I miss them a lot. And it's just this lack of the fact that they don't exist anymore, I really miss them and I struggle seeing them anywhere. So I wonder how is that for you? Thank you.
Thank you. I feel very fortunate that I come from my mother's side of the family being Serbian. They have a very strong culture of, I don't know what you call it, you know, remembering people who've passed away and keeping them very, very close, you know. So it was with my grandmother that I, you know, I spent a lot of time with her when I was a kid, and she lived in Belgrade in Serbia. So we would go to the cemetery easily once a week, if not more. I mean, it was a given, you know, it was the most regular thing that we did. And we had this whole ritual that we'd do. And she had this like kit to take to the cemetery that was like a bag to hold the water for the flowers. We'd buy the flowers and take the scissors and cut the flowers and, you know, do all this stuff. And it's a Greek Orthodox tradition. So then we'd go to the church afterwards and light candles and kiss the picture of Christ. And supposedly, I don't remember this so well, but even when I was very young and I used to go and do this with her, you know, my mother and grandmother would laugh and say, you know, how much sort of gravitas I would bring to this. You know, I took it extremely seriously and I really sort of bought into it. But my grandmother and my mother have this sort of extraordinary talent for keeping people alive. And my grandmother suffered horrible tragedies and losses, like from the Second World War onwards. And she, her parents were killed, her father was killed, her younger brother was killed in the war. And then during the course of her life, she lost lots of siblings. And it was very, very hard. But she talked about them. She kept them all so alive to me that I literally feel like I knew them, you know, especially her mother, for example, who died, I think, 2 years before I was born. She just, you know, the way that she talked about her, and then my mum, when they got together and they started like exchanging stories, and they were just funny, like so funny, and they would quote her and they would do impressions of her, and you know, I just felt like she was in the room with us, and I have a couple of pictures of her. And then after my grandmother passed, and that was very hard, my mum and I have, you know, we've come to the same spot with that now, and some of the funniest times I've had with my mom is when we invoke my grandmother and, you know, what she would have said or done in a certain situation, and we will be howling, you know. It's such a happy remembrance, like, you know, we and she's just there, and then something will happen and my mom will just put on my grandmother's voice and say like, ooh, you know, what she would have said there, you know, some kind of scandal or, you know, something she would have disapproved of. And so in that sense, you know, when I say that it's still going on, another thing that I see, you know, again, just being in this middle generation that I'm in now, you know, I've got now that kind of rounded view of, you know, my daughter and also the people who went before me. And it's very hard to articulate, but, you know, we'll talk about like causes and conditions, but I can see things from the past, like from my family, that manifest in Cora, whether it's like it's certain traits or energies, or, you know, when I just think of all the history and everything that brought her to this moment, like it's still so much alive. There'll just be this glint in her eye where I can see my grandfather, you know, or this kind of way that she moves her face where I can see like my husband's sister or something, you know. I can see so much of this sort of genetic, physical, historical, cultural, like everything that's just living in her. How's it for you, Teresa?
Yeah, it's a mixed. People who passed away, I really loved. I miss them a lot. I, of course, also remember them and keep them alive. Thank you.
Carolina, who's celebrating a new life today.
Yes. Yeah. My niece Carolina gave birth to Victoria today, and we're all very happy. Thank you. Thank you for your talk and making it so personal, so personal. I particularly enjoyed your talking that it's all happening right now. And you're talking about how we get hooked on the directionality of time. It also made me think about the Metta Sutta that we chanted today, where that where it ends with the phrase, "The one who achieves the way will be freed from the duality of birth and death." And I'm further reminded in your poem of the saying that our last act should be a bow. Thank you.
Great.
Thank you as well, Vanessa, for your talk. I'm amazed at the power of this way of getting together for being so intimate and so personal, and just sitting in the dark, bathing in your voice and seeing all your faces here. It's really remarkable. And the thought that I had and the question I have for you is about whether there is something uniquely distinct about death as a kind of loss, if it is, that's what it is, or if it's just like the really sharp end of a spectrum of know different kinds of loss or grief, or something that we are most attached to, whether it's our own death and the way that we think about that, or the deaths of other people. You know, is it qualitatively different in some way from you know, feeling the loss of other things? Even as we were sitting listening to you talk, I felt there was a part of me that was already mourning the loss of this moment. Like, it's just, you know, it felt so good. And it's like, oh, it's going to end. And oh, maybe there's going to be like a period in my life where this kind of thing isn't happening. And so in some way, like every moment is already in its coffin, like at the opposite end of the spectrum. I don't know. I guess my suspicion, my instinct at this point is that actually it's not different. That the dualism around kind of me versus you, life versus death, the difference between different things is like that's the ultimate distinction. They just carry different valences, different powers to them. And the death of yourself or the death of someone else is just especially potent and meaningful. But I don't know that it's, that it's a distinct thing as opposed to other kinds of loss of things that you're attached to. So I wondered if you had a thought on that.
Yeah.
We can hear echo.
Yeah, sorry. Loudspeaker that. And even I think a while back I was talking or thinking about, you know, loss, like little losses, about the art of losing. That was, you know, that was something that I was thinking about, like how you can cultivate that in yourself and notice, like you say, you know, literally there's a little death every second. You know, something is always passing, it's always changing. We're in a state of constant flux, but the way that our brains are wired, it's to make everything seem solid and unchanging. And then we get terribly surprised, you know, when something changes, or we think that that's what we're, you know, we're, I think I brought this up when I talked about it before, you know, we're awfully pleased with ourselves for being Buddhists and practicing this and, you know, like understanding change, and something, you know, comes along and hits you around the head and you realize that, you know, you weren't in the least bit ready for this. And I think for me, that just pushes me further towards, you know, this practice of loss you know, really just diving into it when it happens, whether it's the car keys or the cat or, you know, any number of things that can happen. There's just, yeah, I mean, I think when I think about it, you know, when it comes into that spectrum of arising and falling, rising and falling, arising and falling, and observing that that's, you know, that's it, that's the rhythm. It's just the on and on, on and off. Having said that, you know, there's something so shocking, so hard to get your head around a death. I was thinking recently about like a book that really inspired me when I was younger was Somerset Maugham's The Razor's Edge. Has anybody read that? The Razor's Edge? Yeah, it's a classic, like, it's a very inspirational book. And, you know, the main character, he kind of, it's set in early 1900s, I think, in England. And the main character is, you know, this guy who kind of goes off to war and then comes back and he's completely changed. And he decides to, you know, reject everything in his society and just, you know, basically become a spiritual seeker and go to India and sit with gurus and, you know, just finally just let everything drop off. But the line that he comes back with, you know, when he's explaining to this person that he loves, you know, about this change that's happened, and he says, the line that he says is, the dead are so dead. He's so dead. And when you see, if you see a, I don't know, a dead body or someone you love that's passed away, or you feel, you know, you feel that coldness and that irreversibility that just cannot compute in your mind, you know, the loss when somebody goes. The first time I experienced it, when my grandfather died, I was younger, absolutely adored my grandfather, and he died very suddenly. And I just remember that feeling of like that, you know, it feels that you can do something about everything else, but this is one thing you can do nothing about. And it's really hard for our brains to take that in, I think. But I think the training and the practice is, like you say, it's in, you know, that's, you know, given that hopefully someone's not dying in your life every day, then you, instead you work with what you've got, and you understand that loss is happening on every level, every moment, and kind of grow that muscle.
Thank you, Vanessa.
It's cheery, isn't it? Brenda.
I feel the need to ask a question to cheer us up a bit. I'm wondering about, you know, I've just been sitting mulling it. Lovely. Thank you very much. Thank you first for your lovely talk. The two things that kind of are coming to my mind. One is the fluidity that you mentioned around Cora's early existence. And the kind of the endlessness that was not yet separated into concrete events or awarenesses. And also the podcast that went viral when the mother was talking about the holding that is always there, it's always available. And I'm wondering, do you think they might be related in some way, in that fluidity and that holding sensation that she was experiencing?
I think so. I mean, as much as I can understand it from the perspective that I'm at, you know, I think that, I think, yeah, I mean, that's what I was seeing, was this sort of symmetry in what Deneen Fendig was talking about. This, you know, she also, there was so much more to it when she was describing her state, but she was describing this feeling of kind of being slowly just taken from her body, you know, that she felt that she was just leaving her body, even though she was, you know, probably days away still from dying. She felt, you know, not in a kind of woo way, like she floated up and saw herself lying there, but she said, you know, there was just this feeling that something was holding her as she was leaving, as she was transitioning. And this kind of immense trust that she felt around that, just this certainty, you know. And I think that, and And it just, I used to marvel at Cora, even when she was, you know, not even when she was tiny baby stage, but even when she was just a little bit older, I was like, even when she could already talk, like she'd never ask things like, well, what are we going to do today? Or like, what am I going to eat later? You know, like just these things, I'd just be like, come on, we're going. Okay. You know, now we're going to go do this. Okay. And, you know, there was just no question of control, or, you know, just, okay, now this is happening. Okay, now this has stopped happening and now this is happening. Or, you know, then there might be a situation where like, oh, but I really like that thing that was happening and I want to continue doing that thing that's happening and now I'm going to throw a fit. But then it's just so, you know, it's just so immediate. Like everything was so immediate. It was just what's in front of us. And, you know, sometimes I try and like talk with her and be like, oh, you know, remember that wonderful thing we did like yesterday? And she's like, I don't want to talk about that. Look what's in front of us, you know. She'd be like that. So yeah, I really, in answer to your question, yeah, I really, you know, that's kind of why I put those two things together, because I can really see that continuity there, I think. Jayashree.
Thank you. God, beautiful. I couldn't find my mouse. Thank you, Nessa. That was beautiful. And I just following up on Brenda's comment and just what you described as this boundlessness. I just love how you described that, Cora. And I kind of was thinking when you described sitting in Zazen as in a coffin, that troubled me. I don't view it that way. And I wonder, and I don't, this is my question to you, is could that be cultural? Because I don't view death as in a coffin. I never have, because obviously for me, that's never been how, when we die, I'm never to be in a coffin. I'm going to be going back to the earth, being cremated, and that's how all the people that my loved ones have passed away have been. So it's a very boundless feeling. And so when I sit in Zazen, for me, it's the experience I look for, that openness, that spaciousness, that going back to where I came from, as opposed to ever being in a coffin. And I wonder if it's just cultural to think of sitting in Zazen as being in a coffin. I mean, it just brought back, just, you know, didn't feel good. And that's why I thought it could it be cultural?
Yeah, I think it's a great point. I think there probably is an element of it that's cultural, but I think there might also be, like, my instinct, and this is just what comes up for me, is that I think that maybe it's exactly that discomfort that you're feeling that's being addressed in that statement. It's that kind of heebie-jeebie side, or that kind of feeling of claustrophobia that we get when we think about a coffin, because it doesn't feel right. It doesn't feel right to think of a body being locked up in a box. It's exactly, you know, it's that opposite. It's that openness, that boundlessness that is the thing. And I think that I'm not sure. My feeling is that it's not, you know, a kind of literal destination that he was trying to point us towards, but just precisely this very human fear and this like unease with that image. But I mean, I agree with you. Like, I think that.
Yeah, and the cultural that I also see is that, so as I was in India, whenever I've been in India, death is all around you and it's ever hidden, you know, and it's there. I mean, you know, the cremation, people's bodies are walked through the streets. People see them openly, and you honor them, you bow when they go. And I also wonder if that's also part of it, is why the so there's more availability of that, of death, mm-hmm. and as opposed to being hidden away. And so it's kind of raised the whole cultural thing for me.
Yeah, and there's so much in that. Yeah, for sure. Thank you, Jaya. People, it's 9:20. I didn't realize it's so late. Should we call it a night?
Les? Oh. Maybe he was just agreeing.
All right. Yes. Yes. Yeah, sure.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.